Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Newborn Libertarian. We have a new guest on. His name is Jason, and his name sounds extremely Jewish. And so, now that I've said that, and it probably makes me sound really strange, I'll go ahead and let him introduce himself.
I'm from New York, so plenty of Jews out there. I don't actually consider myself Jewish, but, you know, my family is. And I was raised in New York and just moved out to Las Vegas 5 or 6 years ago. And I've been working full-time with the Libertarian Party of Nevada. So, pretty much what I do, I'm the political director. And right now, we recently announced the first Libertarian state legislator in the country, so I'm proud of that, and it's exciting. It's an exciting time to be a Libertarian in Nevada.
I don't know if you started out as a Libertarian in the past, but if you could just go ahead and tell me where you started out and your political background and how you ended up as a Libertarian.
Most people typically have the political beliefs that their parents have. But I grew up with, you know, my dad was kind of a Republican and my mom was kind of a Democrat, and neither one of them were terribly political. But I'm old enough to remember when the Soviet Union collapsed, and I was in kindergarten. And I remember people talking about how socialism worked in theory, but not in practice. And, you know, it didn't make a lot of sense to me that something would work theory, but not in practice. To me, if something worked in theory, then it worked in practice. Otherwise, you know, there's something wrong with your theory. So I remember being curious about that and asking for answers and not getting a lot of responses that made very much sense. And I don't think that a lot of the people that I was asking, you know, not just in kindergarten when the Soviet Union collapsed, but during Bill Clinton's presidency when I was in, you know, in grade school and in middle school. I think I found that people were typically pretty confused about what made an economy work or not work. As a result, I got interested in economics and I studied it in college, and I went to Bard College, which at the time was the furthest left, probably still is the furthest left arts college in the United States, according to the Princeton Review. So that was fun. And, you know, I was introduced to people who thought that socialism was not in theory, but also in practice. And before I looked into it, the theory seemed to me that support for socialism was based on an idea that we can create something from nothing. You know, that the intentions of socialism were the part that people thought was the theory, and that was a good thing. But that the results were bad. And this actually kind of leads into the differences between the NAP and consequentialism and some of the mistakes that I think the Libertarian Party has made in selling free market ideas in the past 40 or so years that we've existed.
All right. I would say that's a pretty good lead into our topic. And I would also like to say, whoever the hell is moving around there, we can definitely hear your keys and whatever the heck that is. Our topic today, before I bring that in, I'd like to introduce our debaters in the section. Hello, Christian and Chad.
So, hey, glad to be back on the podcast. Had a busy couple weeks, but I am home again, ready to be the master debater that I am. And that was intentional.
Hello, Liberty people. I'm Chad Thayer. I'm a writer, a blogger, a thinker, and I have a Roman numeral in my name. That's my standard little 5-second intro. I write for jasonstapleton.com as well as a blog that I keep on fifthgenerationllp.com where I talk about ideas of liberty, pop culture, criminal justice, basically whatever is currently occupying my brain, which right now is Martin Shkreli and Turing Pharmaceuticals.
All right, now it is finally time to get into our debate on consequentialism versus NAP. So, Jason, can you go ahead and give us a background on consequentialism?
People's political views should follow from what they're trying to accomplish, commonly described as an is-ought problem. People can have the same beliefs about what a policy does, but have different beliefs about whether that objective is a good thing or not. So I think it's important to establish values before you establish, you know, before you talk about policy. And in my opinion, And it's an opinion that's shared, I think, with a majority of the electorate. The goal of policy should be to raise the standards of living for everyone by as much as possible. And it's an idea that's called utilitarianism, and it was actually, it was, I guess you might say, invented or introduced by J.S. Mill and John Mill and Jeremy Bentham. J.S. Mill, who wrote utilitarianism, also wrote On Liberalism, which at the time was really the introduction to libertarianism. And basically the idea is that the objective of a government or of political policy should be to maximize human happiness or to minimize the amount of human suffering. And that's basically the approach that I take towards politics. I think that any policy that a government adopts should be based on how to meet more of people's needs, how to maximize happiness, how to minimize suffering, and how to allow people to live the kinds of lives that they want to live. And that's the general idea behind consequentialism.
So I'm going to kind of point out the basis of the NAP. It's not a hard thing to understand. It's the non-aggression principle, or, you know, I've heard some people call it the zero aggression principle, which sounds a lot cooler with it's ZAP, the NAP. But basically it means that any form of human interaction, if we're going to look and try to judge something ethically as a basis of some kind of moral code as how humans can interact with each other, the non-aggression principle is basically the bedrock and foundation of libertarian political thought, which is basically, you know, do as you wish as long as you do not harm any other person. And this is kind of like the golden rule, but you have to get it down to a deeper level. The non-aggression principle basically means you cannot initiate violence against someone else. If someone initiates violence against you, by all means, you know, defend yourself or defend your property. Say if someone steals your you know, chair, and you say, well, you initiated aggression against me. Well, the non-aggression principle doesn't say you can't go get your chair back. I mean, you can obviously go reclaim the property that was stolen from you. But the difference, I think, between the non-aggression principle and consequentialism is consequentialism basically seems to focus on the ends of a policy. And if the policy achieves some sort of promoted goal that they have, whereas the non-aggression principle looks at the means and says, look, the goal is going to be the goal, but if the means of this goal violate the non-aggression principle, then the goal is unsound in the first place. We can kind of look at this as a rich corporation. If, you know, Kellogg's becomes the greatest manufacturer, seller of cereal because their cereal is the best and all the customers are willing to give them their money, you know, that's one thing, and it abides by the non-aggression principle. Whereas on the other hand, they could, through consequentialism, they could basically have the exact same end and accomplish the same end, but they could also lobby the government for special privileges to keep other sellers out of the market. And therefore, they could achieve the same end, which consequentialism would look at as a good end, but without the non-aggression principle to view this kind of activity in, it's a moot point, where basically, if you apply it logically, the consequentialism says, just do whatever you want as long as the end is something that I value. And that kind of can, to me, it seems like it's the difference between what's the difference between you and a socialist if you adopt the consequentialist line of thinking? Because then you're just comparing preferences of the size of government and what the goal should be. I'm not really looking at if it was acquired through just means, or if there's a better, more efficient way of doing it if the end was achieved. So I think there are also some areas where this definitely interacts. One of them, I think, is overlaps. I think the free market is one of these things where the obvious results show how superior the free market is to other forms of government or forms of economy. But I'll let Chad kind of go in here and kind of say where they overlap, where he thinks some differences are.
Consequentialism versus the NAP. The NAP is really, as Christian was saying, the NAP is a prohibition on the initiation of violence, force, or fraud. Whereas consequentialism really applies to, consequentialism can be applied to pretty much any decision that you make on an everyday basis. And there are plenty of decisions that are just completely amoral. Like me deciding whether I want to go to the gym this afternoon or do this podcast is an amoral decision. It doesn't deprive anybody else of their liberty. It doesn't really affect anybody other than me. So there's really no moral element there. And in decisions where there's no moral element, by all means, try to maximize your outcome. One of the issues that that Christian started to touch on when saying, you know, if we're going to sort of apply consequentialist thinking, as Jason was introducing it, the first thought that popped into my head is, you know, who's a huge consequentialist is Bernie Sanders. Basically, every one of Bernie Sanders' arguments is that the outcome of what we're going to do is going to be better than what we have to do to achieve it. So we're going to take healthcare and we're going to give it to everybody, and that's going to be good. Now, in order to do that, he's got to take a lot of money from other people. So this is an area in which consequentialism and the NAP sort of diverge. And the NAP would say, it doesn't matter how good your goal is. One of the things that I always think of when thinking of the NAP is the statement, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Pretty much everybody throughout history, you know, from the worst dictators to Mother Teresa, had in mind a desirable end, that they were willing to employ whatever means that they felt were justified in order to achieve that end. So on one end, you have Mother Teresa employing charity and you know, virtues that we would all admire. And on the other end, you have Adolf Hitler, who had a desire, had an ends, the end of the Jews, that he thought was desirable. And so if that end is desirable enough, you can essentially justify whatever means you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very common that critiques of consequentialism are based on consequences. And when that happens, you're not really arguing against consequentialism. You're arguing against, you know, decision making is not based on, you know, is this a good goal? And if so, anything is justified to do it. Consequentialist decision making is basically a formula called moral calculus. Are the means that are necessary justified by the end, right? And philosophers will make thought experiments where they talk in terms of utils, or a measure of utility, where do we gain more utility in the end than we lose through the means? And I think the idea that socialism is consequentialist and libertarianism is based on the NAP is a fundamental reason that libertarianism is so unpopular and socialism is so popular, not only in the United States, but worldwide. I think it's very easy for people to claim, as Bernie Sanders does, you know, in a socialist world, we would have free healthcare, we would have free college. And if your response is, but you have to steal to do that, then I think most people would agree that stealing is worthwhile, especially when you say you're going to steal from people like, you know, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and the Koch brothers, whose consumption isn't really going to change because you take a portion of their income, right? If you could convince me that you can make the world a better place, you can provide universal healthcare, you can provide universal education by redistributing wealth from people who aren't even going to use it to benefit their own consumption, it's something that I would support without hesitation. The reason I'm a libertarian is on the basis of the consequences. I think that the reason we have lifespans that are dramatically higher than they were 100 years ago, the reason that we have an educated, literate population and we didn't have one 100 years ago, is that free markets have allowed standards of living to rise by coordinating, the buying and selling and production and distribution of the things that people want and need. And I think when you tell people that the reason you support a free market is because of the NAP, what people hear is, I would rather live in a dystopian Mad Max style wasteland than Bernie Sanders' Star Trek future where everybody is healthy and happy and educated. And I don't think I mean, I'm not sure that I hear anything that different, which is why when I talk to Democrats, and especially when I talk to Bernie Sanders Democrats, I like to say that that our values are more or less in alignment, and we differ on our understanding of what the policies in question will, you know, will, what the results of those policies will be. And traditionally, libertarian philosophers and thinkers for a long time have been consequentialist, not only going back to J.S. Mill and Jeremy Bentham and Adam Smith and those guys, but also as recently as, you know, Henry Hazlitt and Milton Friedman and Hayek and Mises and those guys were all consequentialists, and the exceptions were Ayn Rand and Murray Rothbard. And I think Murray Rothbard and Ayn Rand really did a disservice to not only, you know, explicit libertarianism, the Libertarian Party, and the idea that the government should be smaller in terms of how much control they have over our personal and economic lives, but in particular this idea that socialism is good, socialism works. The problem with it is you've got to step on someone's toes to get there, right? And I don't think that most people who support the NAP would support it if they believe that free markets trend towards concentrations of wealth and power, right? Like, whatever it is that some corporation provides, you know, let's say it's Ford providing cars. If people believe that Ford's invention of the automobile would have led to Ford being the only producer of the automobile, you know, for eternity, and competition wouldn't have developed next generations of cars, and everybody would still be driving Model Ts if not for the government's interference, I don't think there would be very many people who support the NAP.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and stop with it, because Jason bringing up a lot of good points that we want to make sure we get to. I wanted to stop here just to bring up, I think a lot of what this brings up, I think there's a huge misunderstanding, I think, that comes with the NAP, and I think a lot of this also comes from an article that Matt Zielinski did that has long since been deconstructed, I think, but this is not about me and my opinions exact, because I want you guys to discuss it, so I'm going to throw the floor to Chad real quick and then to Christian afterward to go ahead and go ahead, Chad, and the floor is all yours.
We have the same goals, but, you know, we just, as libertarians, we just need to communicate to the average voter that the free market is what works best, is what's going to help maximize their standard of living. I actually think that that's what the Libertarian Party has been trying to communicate to people for the past 40 years. The problem is it just doesn't work. It just does not land. So let's look first at something like Bernie Sanders' campaign, because that's catching on with a lot of people. Bernie Sanders talks a lot about issues of fairness. You'll hear right-wing politicians talk about this as well when they talk about things like immigration. You know, when you're talking about what appeals to voters, yeah, everybody wants their standard of living maximized, but it's a very abstract issue. To try to get into why the free market works best, you're really getting into sort of an economic discussion of history, of what things like the minimum wage do. That doesn't land for the average person. As Jason Stapleton was saying a couple of days ago, you know, the average person, they vote with their gut. They don't vote with their head. And what lands for most vote, like, do I feel like the candidate cares about me? Do I feel that the person is relatable? And the sense of justice. Are these policies going to be fair? That's, you know, that's what we're meaning so unfair. And for most people, if you try to tell them that we're just going to take a current system that's and make it even more free market, they think of that as being just fundamentally more than less. Another kind of counterfactual that you see both in socialism and in Keynesian economics, where if the program doesn't work, it's not because it wouldn't have worked. It's just a failure of size and scale and commitment. So there almost is no null hypothesis when it comes to, because you'll hear dyed-in-the-wool socialists say, well, you know, the Soviet Union wasn't socialism. It started out socialist, but then they just bastardized it. And it really would have worked if they hadn't had Stalin and Gorbachev and Khrushchev. You know, so that's another issue where trying to argue consequentialism to people, you can do it, and there are certain people that will be open to it, but the ones that are more committed, they don't have that methodology whereby to falsify the claims of the system that they're making. Christian, I'll let you jump in with some of the other points.
Yeah, so I'm glad he brought up Henry Hazlitt and Ludwig von Mises, and it's true that especially Mises was definitely from the utilitarian perspective, but I also want to go back and address Bastiat, because some of the things that Jason brought up as pertaining to, you know, redistributing wealth or some kind of social safety net, which Hayek actually believed in, or providing some sort of, you know, objective, util measuring societal benefit, where you really have to look at Bastiat's broken window. Because if you're distributing resources from one area and into another, and Hazlitt goes into this in What is Unseen, you know, you supposedly in the short term, you know, you see the bridge that was built, where you see the healthcare that was provided. What you don't see is all the other forms of production and investment that could have taken place that people would have voluntarily chosen, as opposed to having this health, you know, their free healthcare, which would end up being. And then if we add Mises into the situation with the socialist calculation error, if you're going to redistribute income from one person to another, that has to come through taxation. And what is taxation except the involuntary extortion of someone's money, which means they're not voluntarily giving it to you, which means the person who is handling the revenue or the taxation, they can funnel all kinds of money towards whatever funds they want and say, see, look at this, what I built. Look at this bridge, where the bridge fits their end, but it doesn't necessarily fit society's end, or the bridge would have been built anyway. Except the bridge would have probably been built more efficiently, because there tends to be a mismanagement of costs when it comes to socialism and central planning and even local city planning when it comes to roads and bridges and this and that. There's no way for them to really control costs. And you see this in the medical field, trying to make things more fair and appeal to people's justice and redistribute money by forcing people to go into risk pools where they don't really need to be in to subsidize other people. The utilitarian perspective, if you're going to ignore the non-aggression principle to bring about some societal end, whether it be something good such as state-run cancer research or state-run healthcare or infrastructure or this and that, there's no way for you to accurately predict or correctly identify how many resources need to be there, because your ability to tax, ignoring the NAP, and your ability to tax and take money involuntarily from other people doesn't let you understand their utility and their satisfaction from their money. Because I know you talked about utils and philosophers and this and that, but I'm going to have to say, you know, this makes those philosophers wrong. There's no objective util measurement that applies to everyone in society or in the world. So basically the NAP allows for people to pursue their own interests and pursue their own satisfaction to the best of everyone's abilities, not just the mob saying, oh, we want this and you're going to give it to us because you're a minority. That can lead you down the road to serfdom, basically, to bring in Hayek to it. And I think Rothbard did a great service to the libertarian movement. He single-handedly really revived the libertarian movement in the United States. I know you had Friedman and this and that, but it was really Murray Rothbard that got all these things put together. Whether it be, you know, getting the Libertarian Party going, starting to found Cato, and this and that. But, there's one more thing. Oh, on Henry Ford, you said what would happen if Henry Ford had monopolized the market, which basically Henry Ford was known for not trying to use patents and not using the government to protect his industry, whereas all these other car builders were, even in the absence of a government trying to stop a monopoly from happening. You know, the free market eats around the edges of whatever monopoly that may exist in the absence of barriers to entry. And Henry Ford, and I think I said this in another podcast, Henry Ford said, well, let them do all the patents or stuff. Let them spend the money on that. We're still going to innovate and be better. So the idea that we'd all be driving Model Ts, I think, is disingenuous. I think there would be more competition. I think libertarianism even if his people don't recognize it, I think worldwide is actually gaining steam because you see the utilitarian results it produces, whether it be China relaxing their policies and their special economic zones, or you look at Hong Kong and Singapore, the United States. So even if it's not directly called libertarianism, the liberalization of the rest of the rest of the world is evidence as to why you don't need to central plan societal ends.
I want to jump in with two quick points to wrap up what Christian's saying, and then we can let Jason sort of get back to his argument. So, Jason, when you were saying earlier that the consequentialist argument that you want to be maximizing happiness and minimizing suffering, those are actually they may sound like one goal, but they're actually two separate goals. So, maximizing happiness might result in an end like getting everyone a speedboat, whereas minimizing suffering might look like, well, we just got to get everybody food. And sort of to what end do you try to strike a balance between the two is kind of complicated. And it leads to the question of, well, who is in best position to decide what is best for you, the individual best position, or is it somebody else, some bureaucrat, some policy wonk, some academic that knows better than you what it is that you need to be happy?
Right. So the basic idea, there are two main arguments there. One is the question of messaging and whether it's productive to use the NAP to sell libertarianism and what the Libertarian Party has traditionally done, whether it's succeeded or failed. And the other is the problem of moral calculus, right? How do we decide what maximizes, outcomes? Whether we should emphasize happiness, whether we should emphasize minimizing harm. And those are hard questions, but they're consequential questions. So I'll take, I guess, the first question first, whether this is good for messaging. And I agree that your average voter isn't going to walk into a voting booth thinking about the advantages of constrained and unconstrained societies and, the mechanisms by which free markets redirect resources in the most productive ways and the mechanisms by which free markets prevent monopolization from happening, the way free markets promote innovation. And in fact, the reason I used Ford and Model T's as the example is because Harry Brown, now dead but one time libertarian candidate for president, said that if we had put the government in charge of automobiles, everybody would be driving Model T's and saying, if not for the government, there'd be no cars at all. And that's an important message. And I think that's the message that sells, right? The message that sells isn't, this is why our policies work and this is why socialist policies fail. That's a tough thing to explain, and only very high information voters, people who are very, very interested in politics or economics, are gonna be interested in or even understand those questions. But when we're trying to sell something other than those objectives, we're doomed to failure, right? Because when people go into a voting booth, they think of one of two things: either how does my vote benefit me, or how does my vote benefit the people I care about, society in general, the world as a whole. Right, you don't typically have people going into voting booths and thinking about how does this vote impact some deontological principle like the NAP, and why should I care about that in the first place? Right? Does this politician care about me? Well, if he's doing what he does because he's concerned about outcomes, then yeah, he probably does. Right. So that's how I would address the messaging question. And in terms of what the Libertarian Party has been doing, I think just by virtue of the fact that we associate socialism with consequentialism, the Libertarian Party and other people who have been advocating for free markets, even nonpartisans like AFP, have clearly done a poor job of making a utilitarian argument because people don't associate consequentialism with good outcomes, even though your argument, the second argument, the argument about moral calculus, made exactly that point, right? So in terms of moral calculus, I think that the best way to measure utility and the best way to determine what's in the best interest of society and the people in society and the best way to maximize happiness at the same time as minimizing suffering, is to give people control over their own lives and to let profits and losses measure the best way to meet people's wants and needs, right? So I think that by giving people control over their own lives, money can be a measure of utility, and it's not a measure that will overweight happiness or that will underweight harm, or vice versa, because it's a measure that takes into account people's different preferences, which is why within the broader philosophical construct of consequentialism, I would identify as a preference utilitarian. I think the best way to measure utility is by the meeting of people's preferences and giving people the power to value their own happiness or minimizing their own suffering, you know, maximizing leisure time, whatever it is people value. And I think that free markets are a very, very good mechanism to coordinate those things. So I think it's more of a practical difference. But when it comes to the distinction between NAP and consequentialism, saying that a consequentialist approach would have poor consequentialist results isn't really a critique, right? You're just saying that that's not how the moral calculus works out. And if you're saying the moral calculus falls on the side of free markets, I would agree with you completely, and that's why I'm a libertarian.
Yeah, so the consequentialist argument, and yes, once again, I'm aware that I'm making a consequentialist argument against the consequentialist argument, but the issue with consequentialism fundamentally is that there are no checks on consequentialism. There's no principle check. There's no prohibition of anything. Because if the ends are good enough, you can justify any means. And what you were saying about, well, we need to give people control over their own lives and use, you know, money as a measure of utility. For a lot of people, that's not really what they want. Yes, in an abstract way, they want responsibility over their own lives and they want autonomy, but they don't want autonomy when it comes to bearing the costs of that. And a lot of the socialist messaging is essentially, we're going to alleviate your downside responsibilities, because typically, you know, freedom is a two-edged sword. It comes with the benefits of freedom, but it also comes with the costs. So if you make a good investment, you make money. If you make a bad investment, you lose that money. Well, most people are looking for easy ways to sort of hedge their downside and maximize their upside. That's why the safety net exists. That's why you see, you know, just sort of all kinds of offloading of responsibility onto the government. Anything from, you know, healthcare to sex education. You know, I don't want to have a difficult conversation with my children about sex, so, you know, they should be learning that in school. I think one of the big problems when you get back to what you were saying about the moral calculus is you still haven't answered the question of who decides. Who's in the best position to answer that question? Because as soon as you start lumping people together into collectives, you're going to have individuals within the collective that have a lot of times diametrically opposed interests. And so is it just a question, if we're using money as a measure of utility, then, you know, helping a wealthier group of people rather than a poorer group of people, even if that poorer group of people is larger, would seem, you know, if that policy returns more money to those people, would seem to be justified sort of under money as measurement of utility. And I think there's also that, you know, that old platitude that I think is very true in this, which is the best things in life are free. A lot of times, money does not capture money. It's hard to put a monetary value on things like time, on things like freedom, on things like autonomy. I mean, you can go ahead and try to price those out, but it's really difficult because each person has a different subjective value.
Yeah, so it's absolutely true that it's difficult to price these things, and the And it's very easy to demonstrate that when the government gets involved, as they have been, it becomes nearly impossible to price these things, right? So as a utilitarian and as a consequentialist, the reason I came to the conclusion that money is the best way to do moral calculus, assuming the government is not involved, is because of, you know, my understanding of economics, right? The causality where from my values to my scientific beliefs, and that's how I derived libertarianism, right? So the reason that I believe that money is a good way of coordinating people's value, and the reason that I believe that it won't favor the wealthy, for instance, is that on the basis of you know, the study I've done on economics in college and afterwards, and not only libertarian economics like Hayek and Hazlitt and Mises, but also Keynes and Samuelson and Malthus and foundationally what are traditionally considered left wing economists, right? Because the fundamental question of economics and the fundamental question, I think, of policy is that economies are made up of real things, right? Even if that real thing is leisure time. So if people are choosing socialism out of a preference for leisure, they're going to end up with less of it relative to the other things they want to need, because people want leisure time, right? Leisure time has grown in like along with the growth in standards of living in other ways, right? The more food people have, the less time they spend working. And I think the idea that people can make these decisions by having a central government allocate resources is the central problem for libertarianism. This is what I want, and that's fine, it could be whatever it is, but is the best way to get it to allow the government to get it for me or to get it myself? And if I thought that the government could get it for me, then, you know, then I wouldn't be a libertarian, right? But to tell people that we're libertarians because we don't think that we should try to get the things that make us, you know, the things that we prefer, the real things that we prefer, then I don't think we can sell that argument. And when we have people, you know,
what do you mean by that? Who says we're libertarians because we don't try to get the things that we prefer? I've never heard that argument ever mentioned to me from a libertarian.
Well, I don't think most people who support the NAP would say that we're libertarians because we want to live in a dystopian hell, you know, where wealth and power concentrate in the hands of a few people. But what I have heard libertarians say, and what I think most people who are not libertarians hear when they're talking to people who are trying to sell the NAP, is, I don't care if that's the outcome. I don't care if it's true, although maybe I think it's not. And in fact, in most cases, I think people who are libertarian on the basis of the NAP are fundamentally consequentialist. But what they're arguing, and I think what people hear, is the outcome doesn't matter. The ends don't matter. What matter are the means, right? As long as transactions are voluntary, if wealth concentrated to the point that we ended up with a very, very small handful of people or even one individual who controlled all the wealth, and then a huge population of people who are not being coerced, then that's the solution that they would support.
But that's kind of a red herring, because when people are arguing in favor of the NAP, they're not saying the outcome doesn't matter. What they're saying is, by following these principles, we can achieve a desired outcome. There's nobody. Maybe there's a few, but there's very few people in libertarianism that say, you know, consequences entirely be damned, I'm going to follow the NAP into the zombie apocalypse, and that's just you know, that's just the way it goes. That I don't think anybody actually thinks that.
So I think, yeah, I think Jason mentioned that the difference is between libertarians and everyone else. I think what he was trying to get at is saying libertarians think that we should go get it for ourselves because we're the best at deciding for ourselves, or should the government decide that for you? But here's the thing with democracy and with consequentialism as it's defined, as if it is, if, and if utilitarianism is defined as, what makes the most people happy as opposed to what makes the least amount of people unhappy? Well, that would obviously be socialism if a majority of people all want free healthcare at the expense of the people who want to pay for it themselves. And even if that were to be the policy, that doesn't mean that the people didn't go out and get that free healthcare for themselves, because you know what they did do? They went out and voted for it. It's just the same thing as going out and hiring a hitman for yourself to take some of your neighbor's wealth to get it to you. You still went out and got that for yourself. The consequence, the end, still was the same. You got your quote unquote better healthcare in the near term. But what you did in the meantime is you did violate the NIP and aggression and not allowing someone else to pursue their own means of happiness at the same time. See, this is the problem to me with consequentialism, that at the ends as, okay, first one to, you know, it kind of like a, if you look at it in terms of like a sporting event, like a basketball or a football game, well, the goal is to score more points than the other team, or in basketball, the goal is to get the ball in the net. Well, the consequentialist wouldn't care about if the rules are you dribble the ball on the way to the basket. The consequentialist would pick up the ball, run all the way across the court, and then shoot it in the basket. And they said, well, I made it in the basket, didn't I? And if most of the players on their team vote in favor of running the ball into the basket as opposed to dribbling the ball, then, well, the consequentialists win because there's more of them than there are on the other side. It's just – and you talk about libertarians not caring if we end up in a Mad Max-type dystopia. I would argue that if you look at socialism, socialism always seems to devolve into the Mad Max sort of dystopias. When you look at Venezuela, the collapse of the Soviet Union and this and that. And the free market societies, or the relatively free market societies, end up becoming the successful ones. But to say that we wouldn't care if wealth concentrated into the hands of a small amount of people, I would say, well, look at how that happens with the government in charge. Wealth and power concentrates into the hands of a small amount of people when there's a central agency with a monopoly on force and violence, because they end up being bought and co-opted by the people who have wealth and power, who use the force and violence to sustain their wealth and power instead of satisfying the consumer to sustain their wealth and power. I mean, that's the difference. When you look at it as in terms of a market society, you could say, oh, well, the libertarians don't care if, you know, one company takes over the world. That's like saying, well, you don't care if everyone's allowed to go outside and then the sun explodes. I mean, it's kind of a non sequitur. It wouldn't happen. It hasn't happened over the course of history. What we have had happen is we'd have people saying, I can make the most amount of people happy at the expense of the least amount of people, getting on board the populist train, eating the rich, you know, throwing the priesthood in the guillotine and throwing them in the river in terms of the French Revolution, and using their desired ends, their own subjective desired ends, to trample upon the ends of other people. So the difference between the NAP as not caring about the ends is kind of false. The NAP allows everyone to care about their own ends that they own want to achieve, except the thing that matters for everyone to achieve these ends are the means. If the means are peace and nonviolence and non-aggression, then everyone can achieve the ends they want. They just have to satisfy other people. Whereas if you're going to ignore the NAP and you say, well, the means don't really matter if we have a really good end, that leaves it up to the people with the biggest guns or the most people on their side to decide what the ends are and trample on everyone else regardless of the means.
Can I throw out one question to just kind of, I think, focus this a little bit? Just a question for you. So, Jason, can you give me an example, like a realistic sort of present day example of where you feel like violating the NAP for consequentialist reasons is both acceptable and preferable to adhering to the NAP?
Well, I don't. I actually think that the NAP is a perfectly reasonable, practical conclusion of consequentialist aims, right? I actually don't think that the government should be doing these things. I don't think that there are cases where we're capable of providing better alternatives for people through coercive means or through violating the NAP. But that's not a question of value, right? That's a question of consequence. What I think I heard was nobody does that. And then a response that did exactly that, right? So you know, and then followed by an explanation of why nonviolence and peaceful means and voluntary exchange and free markets typically have better consequential results. And I would agree with all of that. I would absolutely agree that free markets trend towards better results, and better results really for everybody. I think the fact that nobody gets left behind in the long term in a free market makes it really, really easy to do the moral calculus and to say that in a free market, profits and losses and money are the best way to coordinate human action in such a way that people don't get left behind, right? But the first response was, you know, people who support the NAP really do care about these results. We just don't believe what the results are going to be. And then the second response was, well, but if these are the results, then if we can get universal health care by promising universal health care the way Bernie Sanders does, then people are going to vote to do that because they're going to want to do that. And it's true, they will vote to do that. But what they should know when they walk into the voting booth, or at least what we should tell them and let them decide, is that that's not what they're going to get. It may be what they want, but what they're going to get is the kind of collapse that we've seen in Venezuela and North Korea. The reason there's no food on the shelves in Venezuela is not because people in Venezuela voted for there not to be food on the shelves. It's because they voted for the government to provide the food, right? And it's something that it's a fairly easy distinction to sell, I believe, right? I don't think the average American would vote for a policy to make everybody a millionaire by printing $1 million for every American and mailing them a check, right? So for the same reason, I think the best way, not only for us to message, but the best way for us to think about libertarianism is as a way to organize society that maximizes outcomes for everybody.
So I think, yeah, Kristen, I'll finish this real quick. I think you said earlier in the debate that you believe that, you know, both the left wing and the right wing, that they ultimately have the same ends in mind, you know, human happiness, utopia, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if both sides have the same end in mind, then really you're only debating over the means. That's the only fundamental point that you can argue about if your methodology, if your ends are the exact same.
Well, I mean, this is going to sound like I'm taking a shot at Republicans and conservatives, but there are alternatives to consequentialism and the NAP. In particular, from the left wing, there are people who value equality more than they value consequences, right? So there are people out there who would support a policy to bring down the poor, even if it didn't bring up standards, to bring down the rich, even if it didn't bring up standards of living for the poor. And on the right, there are people who believe in divine command theory or certain other metaphysical values that are not consequentialist. But that's only because in
their subjective opinion, they derive more utility out of the rich being equal to the poor than they do from an alternative. So even if you have this what would seem to be a non-consequentialist view, it really is just you just have different preferences. It's still consequentialism, just with reversed preferences to something like what we see today.
I think Jason's right when he says, you know, we can make the utilitarian argument, and I usually fall back on my readings of Mises when I do this, because as libertarians, we have the utilitarian argument. We have the free market argument that kind of trumps anything that they really throw at us. The difference is, you know, if Jason thinks the best way is not to go about, you know, telling people about the NAP to get people, you know, into the doorway of libertarianism, I kind of disagree. You can't just walk up to someone at the voting booth and say, here, read Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, read What Has Government Done to Our Money, and read some Milton Friedman while you're at it too before you go into vote, because people aren't going to take the time to read that and understand that. They do understand Bernie Sanders saying, I'm going to give you free healthcare and it's going to be great. Well, you know what? That is their subjective end that they want to accomplish. That's their consequentialist end. However, I find that a lot of people also respond very well to the non-aggression principle. Say, hey, remember when you said that you shouldn't hurt people and take their things? Yeah, maybe you should abide by that. And guess what? If you don't hurt people and you don't take their stuff, society improves as a result. And then show them those results because of that. Because the difference is, and Chad hit the nail on the head here, is that the left has their ends that they value, the right has their ends that they value, and the libertarians have their ends that they value. The difference is, the left and the right are each making a bid to try to get the majority of people on their side. and they're each trying to show people why their ends are better and why their ends will improve their lives at the expense of some minority or at the expense of someone else's life. But the libertarians are wholly separate and saying, hey, we're not trying to take away someone else's end, because it at the end of the day, if you consequentialism and the NAP and growing society, it comes from who should decide the ends. And the answer that the libertarian would say, well, nobody, no one person decides the end. That's for everyone to try to decide. And that's the reason why the non-aggression principle is not necessarily the starting axiom. It's kind of the logical derivation of, you know, where does human society flourish? It's where people are allowed to make their own decisions, allowed to come to their own ends. And of course, there's a lot of room for overlap with the NAP and consequentialism. You know, what end do you want and how do you achieve it? The difference is, if you're looking at it in terms of society, and even from an individualist perspective, the NAP, if you follow the NAP, logically, you're going to not only produce the best results for you, but the best results for society as well. It's when you go, you know, like the Robinson Crusoe argument, if Robinson's on one side of the island, Friday's on the other, and Robinson's end is to get as many berries as he can, he could go rob from Friday, but then that will make Friday get a surplus of berries. The best thing that they can do is each, you know, Friday's good at catching fish. I mean, or other way around. Robinson's good at catching fish. Friday's good at picking berries. And then they trade and they sustain their lifestyle, as opposed to Robinson wanting to go and just rob and rob and rob and oppress Friday until eventually she has no will to do anything of her own. So I think the difference between using consequentialism as a tool is that it can easily be thrown right back in your face when someone says, well, yeah, well, the majority of people agree with me and that's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and you know, and something that the NAP allows us to do within the frame of consequentialism is just to say, well, no, sorry, there are no ends where killing people is justified. If you don't establish some kind of framework whereby you have a prohibition on theft, on violence, and murder, then eventually, and it has happened many times before, someone will come along and they will promise people an ends for which they are willing to murder their fellow human beings. And that ends doesn't have to be all that desirable. It can be as simple as, we think Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Therefore, we must invade Iraq. Those ends of Saddam not having a bomb were desirable enough for, you know, 50% of the American population to support murder, which, you know, you can say, well, no, murder, murder doesn't, it's not very justifiable under the right moral calculus. But the problem is, like, that's your moral calculus. There are people out there for whom they are willing, you know, people who are willing to murder for the right ends. I was at a gas station one day, and I got a few times over, I found out later, over $400. There were dudes that shot this guy because he owed them $400. So, you know, that's something that consequentialism, I think, has a flaw in, because there's no checks, there's no restraint on what means you can use to achieve your desired ends.
Okay, so I think we're starting to get to the end point of this whole thing. And the question that I want to pose to all of you, starting with Jason, is I'm starting to see that there can be something that can be gained with using the NAP and consequentialism to get the libertarian message out. And what I'm starting to focus on lately is trying to figure out how we can get the libertarian message out, whether the end goal, because I know for a lot of people is what I'm thinking is to get the government more and more out of our lives. And there are people who just want the government out entirely, of course. But what I'm seeing at this point in time, to get us closer and closer to a society where government out, is, of course, to get more people that are focused on the two-party system to start to realize how we can minimize government. And at this point, the tool to that, of course, is having to use the unfortunate political game to start to get people to realize it. And at this point, I am part of the Libertarian Party. That's how I met Jason. And I think part of that is using libertarian message, and we've got to find a way to get people to understand it and understand the principles. But what it's sounding like to me in this debate is the NAP and consequentialism do have some overlap. So how do we get the message out? How are you guys thinking that we can market this to people and help them to understand it, and why this makes more sense if we're trying to make policies, if we're trying to talk about free markets? How are we going to package this to people to make them realize that? And I'll start with Jason on that.
So I think that the most important thing for libertarians to do when they're messaging is to message on an almost person-to-person basis. And it's really kind of a basic sales principle, you know, for other things that's underutilized in politics. So if you're talking to somebody whose values are not consequentialist, then selling them, you know, consequential aims might not be the best thing to do, right? A lot of people, you know, there are a lot of people out there to whom the NAP appeals, right? So the first thing that I want to do as, you know, as the political director for the Libertarian Party of Nevada is find out, you know, where the constituents in the districts that our candidates are running stand on issues. And we actually have very good consumer data and information on our constituents so that we can make those determinations. But in a broader sense, when it comes to the difference between selling results and selling values, I think we have a lot of data that indicates that when we're targeting, you know, the population in general, and when we're targeting people who are not typically libertarian already, when we're, you know, when we're going on media and when we're participating in discussions with Democrats and Republicans, 90% of people across cultures choose the utilitarian option in the trolley problem. And if you're not familiar, the trolley problem is a hypothetical moral question in which a trolley is headed down the tracks towards five people who don't see it coming and will be killed if you allow the trolley to continue. And the only way to stop it is to push one person, and it can't be yourself because you're not fat enough to stop the trolley, but one person who's larger than you are in front of the trolley who will be killed but who will save the five lives. And when you ask people this question, 90% of them across cultures choose the utilitarian option, which of course is to kill the fat man. And I can't envision a moral alternative to that decision. And I think the fact that 10% of that population would choose not to save the five lives at the expense of one is 10% of the population that it's difficult for me personally to identify with, more so, you know, than whatever your beliefs on policy may or may not happen to be, because as long as we have the same values, we can, you know, we can talk about that and kind of make some progress on policy. So that's kind of where I am on messaging and the difference between the NAP and consequentialism.
Yeah. So on the trolley question, I love answering this question because I have a lot of fun answering the question. Honestly, I would not push the fat man to kill the guy. And I think a good way to message this would be, you know, that even that fat man's life matters too. And if you really care about all lives, you know, that fat person's life does matter. But you know what? The people crossing the trolley track should maybe look where they're going first, and maybe the people getting on the trolley should realize that there are certain consequences when they entrust their life to a driver or to a trolley system or to an infrastructure where a trolley could supposedly become a runaway in a split second. Most likely, the government created that infrastructure if that trolley is reacting so badly in the first place. When it comes to messaging, I think that the best thing that could have happened to libertarianism, and this is not from my experience, because I came to it from you know, studying economics and doing this and that. A lot of people you hear saying, oh, I came to libertarianism from Ron Paul. Well, the one thing that Ron Paul was good at that nobody else was good at or even wanted to touch on was telling people what they didn't want to hear, especially running in a Republican primary when it came to the military and the warfare state. This is where libertarians had their chance to shine and had their chance to show why the non-aggression principle, don't go invade other people, stop bombing these countries, because it's your sons and your daughters that end up getting killed. And it's the blowback that comes from occupying these countries and being over there, despite, you know, our the otherwise utilitarian or consequentialist message that people have been getting from Republicans and Democrats for 50 years about why we have to go to these other places and because it's in your best interest and this and that, and try to paint it this way. No, I mean, the libertarians were able to paint this as we are murdering people, and by consequences, our people are getting murdered too, you know. So, and when you look at, you know, Rand Paul, he really watered this message down. He didn't take a firm principled stand on it. That's why I think the non-aggression principle is how you reach out to people. There is a way to reach out for people's compassion. And you know what? What makes libertarianism so interesting for people is that when people finally say, look, I believe you on all these principles, I'm ready to jump in. Now sell me on the details. And that's when we hand them Friedman and Mises and the economic arguments and this and that, because you're not going to get the passerby's attention if you go into a soliloquy about fractional reserve banking. You're going to hit them with, say, hey, I'm the person who doesn't want to kill people. Don't you? And then from there, from the similarities, then you work your way to the differences. And then you show why we actually have the utilitarian perspective. And just want to point out, you know, utilitarianism is not what makes the most people happy at the expense of the least amount of people. That's democracy. Utilitarianism is what objectively is the best solution for a given end. And if your end is to increase the amount of wealth in society and increase the standard of living objectively for people, then utilitarian, in the utilitarian sense, in the objective sense, it's to use the free market. And voila, it just so happens that the NAP is fully practiced and on full display in the free market. So, I mean, that's all I have to say about that, as Forrest Gump would say.
All right, so I guess I'll bring it on home. Okay, so first of all, libertarian messaging, and I'm going to touch on Rand Paul as well. The number one thing that libertarians have to do is just tell the truth. When it comes to politics, there's so much bullshit being slung that, you know, Rand Paul had a golden opportunity to stand up on that stage next to, you know, eight other Republicans who are all feeding the audience just crap, just absolute crap, and you know, not touching on plenty of areas where the Republicans and the Democrats both have blood all over their hands, things like immigration, things like education. He had an opportunity to tell the truth to people, and he elected not to do that in order to try to pander to a conservative base that, frankly, he was never going to win. He's never going to convert Jeb Bush voters into Rand Paul voters. As to how we do the communication of the NAP consequentialism, so I kind of look at this as, I'll call it consequentialism plus. You know, consequentialism, except that you do not have the, you are not allowed to employ the means of violence or fraud. That's, by all means, maximize your ends in every situation, except using those outcomes. The trolley problem is one of those. I was going to address this earlier, but the trolley problem or the lifeboat situation, they're always tossed out to try to disprove that the NAP holds firm in all circumstances and all scenarios under every imaginable thing. Yes, it's a difficult question to answer. Yes, there's some complicated moral weighing and moral calculus that has to be done, but that doesn't mean that the NAP is not applicable to 99.999% of everyone else's lives, and that because there's this one weird situation that nobody has ever been in. I've never heard of it. I've never met anybody that's ever been in the lifeboat scenario or the trolley scenario or any of those where they have to choose to kill somebody to save other people. You know, if you were to run that same experiment where, but you did it in real life and you actually had to push the person in front of a simulated trolley, I would guess you would flip the results. You'd probably get 10% of people that would do it versus, you know, 90% of people that wouldn't. And if you change the calculus even further and you make it somebody you know, almost nobody's going to do it. And that's really where we're at for most of us in the great majority of our lives. We're almost always dealing with people we know. So, you know, that's and the other thing, the last thing I'll say about the trolley problem is that So the idea that, okay, I'm killing one person to save five is the exact same justification that Chris Kyle, the American sniper, used for the 260 people he killed in Iraq. He's saying to himself in his head, well, I'm saving Americans. Yes, they're not right there in front of me like the trolley people would be, but when you get that abstract about it, and you can say, and you can, you're allowed to employ those justifications, you will use means like murder.
The last thing I also want to say about the trolley problem, it kind of paints a picture where if someone else makes a finds themselves in an unfortunate or unlucky situation, or puts themselves in danger, it does kind of paint the picture that, you know, someone else is responsible for throwing their life away, or someone you love is responsible for having being forcefully put in the situation to save someone else's life. Nobody has a mandate where they have to save, you know, the person in the middle of a lake from drowning, unless they were the ones that pushed the trolley or pushed them into the lake in the first place. Chad hit the nail on the head. It's a crazy hypothetical argument that can be used to justify way too many things.
Well, and it's a decision that you don't have the right to make. You don't get to decide if that fat guy sacrifices his life. If he decides that he wants to do that in order to save the five people, he's allowed to do that. But you are not allowed to take his life from him without his consent. And that's fundamentally the issue at hand, is are we allowed to take things from people without their consent? If you say yes, then you can justify almost anything. If you say no, then you're working within a framework that, you know, Christian and I both believe will lead to maximized happiness and maximized outcomes. But even if it doesn't, it is still very important that we behave ethically, you know. I'm not going to say consequences be damned, but, you know, we may have less control over the consequences that we think than we think we do, but we certainly have control over whether or not we're violating other people's persons and property.
Yeah. So it's, I think you could reframe the trolley question and say, look, do you want to control the situation you put yourself in? Do you want to control whether, you know, or you're looking where you're going when you're crossing some train tracks? Do you want to be in control over whether or not you're on the trolley? And do you want to be in control of whether or not someone's going to say, hey, you, I'm throwing you in front of this trolley, and consequences for your life be damned, because I'm going to save five more or whatever. I think people respond to wanting to be in control of their own lives. And, you know, the fat person who, the figurative fat person getting ready to be pushed in front of a trolley, he doesn't have control over his own life. Even though the people walking in front of the train or choosing to get on the train made that decision, they made their bed, but it's the fat guy that has to sleep in it. That's just, it's ridiculous, but I'm done there.
You know, I would stand with the 90% of Americans who would save five lives to save one. And I think discounting their lives because we're claiming that all lives matter, doesn't really follow. But I think we ended on a kind of a positive note. There's some agreement certainly on the idea that the NAP will, that following the NAP will generally, in real world scenarios, which obviously the trolley problem is not, in real world scenarios, the NAP will typically lead to the best consequential outcomes. And I think that's the important takeaway.
Yeah, the trolley problem abstracts things that are never abstract. It turns into a black and white. It turns human life into a math problem. And you know, anybody who's been alive for more than, you know, 5 years knows that it's never that cut and dry.
I mean, if that were true, because, you know, all the trolleys in San Francisco and all the steep hills and this and that, the utilitarian thing to do from that perspective is to import people from where I live, from Oklahoma to San Francisco, because we definitely have a surplus of large people in Oklahoma, into San Francisco, so they can stand on street corners and be ready to stop trolleys that run away.
All right. So I think that was a good and spirited debate, but unfortunately we have to end, or else you'll be listening to this podcast forever. So, Jason, I'll go ahead and allow you to plug your information.
All right, thanks. Well, the first thing I want to plug is John Moore's re-election campaign. He's the only libertarian state legislator in the United States, and the first one from Nevada in history, and the only one in about 20 years. So if you can, please support Assembly John Moore's re-election. I'm not going to say whether he's a consequentialist or an NAPer, But go to reelectjohn.com. The website is under construction, but it's going to look pretty pimp when we're done with it, probably within the next couple of days. And I think getting him reelected will be the first step towards a landslide of reelections in 2018 after we prove that the Libertarian Party is viable on the state legislative level. So check that out. Also, if you have any questions about libertarianism, go to lpnevada.org.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you had fun. I enjoyed the debate. It was nice and spirited and great, full of information. If you want to send us your comments, if you want to give us negative comments, you want to give us great comments, you can hit us up on Twitter at Newborn Liberty. Send us an email at newbornlibertarian@gmail.com. Search out the Facebook group. Just search out Newborn Libertarian. We are on Stitcher as well. And please leave some iTunes comments. We only have 2 comments. So leave us some comments, leave us some ratings, and get the word out to your friends. And like I said, check out Nevada Libertarian Party. And yeah, get the word out. And then until next time, thank you for joining us.